From the heart of The Ohio State University on the Oval, this is Voices of Excellence from the College of Arts and Sciences with your host, David Staley. Voices focuses on the innovative work being done by faculty and staff in the College of Arts and Sciences at The Ohio State University. From departments as wide-ranging as art, astronomy, chemistry and biochemistry, physics, emergent materials, mathematics, and languages, among many others, the college always has something great happening. Join us to find out what's new now.
Joining me today over Zoom is Andrea Sims, associate professor with a joint appointment in the Department of Linguistics and the Department of Slavic and East European Languages and Cultures at The Ohio State University College of the Arts and Sciences. She is affiliated with the Center for Slavic and East European Studies, the Buckeye Language Network, the Center for Cognitive and Brain Sciences, and the Computational Social Sciences Community of Practice. And she is the director of the Dynamics of Morphological Systems Group. Thank you for joining me today, Dr. Sims.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you are a theoretical morphologist, and I'd like you to begin by telling us what this is and maybe begin with a definition of what morphology is.
Sure. Theoretical morphology. Morphology is the area of study in linguistics that looks at word structure. Okay. So many words have internal parts to them that are meaningful. So if you think about the word happiness, we can see that it has at least two parts in it, right? It has happy and it has ness. And the ness part is sort of abstract in its meaning, but it has some meaning related to quality of, and it makes that adjective happy into a noun. So morphology is the area of study that looks at those sort of meaningful parts internally to words and asks how they're structured and how they work in language.
And so a theoretical morphologist would be someone who theorizes about this?
Yes, exactly. So I'm interested in individual languages and the knowledge that speakers have implicitly of the structure of words in their languages, what can be a word, what can't be a word. And I'm also interested in the sort of cross-linguistic angle that languages actually differ quite widely in how much they use word structure in this sense, how much they use morphology. And so it's interesting to think about sort of what are the range of possible ways that languages can be organized and can use word structure.
What is the range? Can you give us a sense of the scope or scale of that range?
Yes, as maximal as you can probably imagine is the answer. So a language like Vietnamese has essentially no word structure. So it will have—
Really?
If you take that example, like happiness, mm-hmm. that we have in English, that's only one word. I don't speak Vietnamese, but you know, roughly speaking, the correspondent to that in Vietnamese would be two words at least, right? One for maybe the adjective and one for, you know, the abstract noun part. So in more technical terms, each of those parts is a morpheme, okay? And the parts that we put together in English to form words, in Vietnamese, each morpheme is a word and each word is a morpheme, roughly speaking. They don't put them together to form larger words out of multiple morphemes. So that's one end. So essentially, Vietnamese does with sentence structure what English will do with word structure in terms of conveying meaning. At the other end of the scale, we have languages that push together lots of morphemes into words so that what English does with sentences, other languages will do with words. So for example, in West Greenlandic, okay, which is a language of Greenland, right? You get things where you get so many morphemes put together in a word that what we might say is an entire sentence in English is actually only one word in that language. So there's the two sort of extremes where a word can be what we think of as a whole sentence in terms of meaning, or a word can be just a little tiny subpart of what we think of as a word.
That's fascinating. I thought you were going to say German at first, but...
German also has, yeah, lots and lots of long compound words. Many people who speak German know that you often in writing have these very long string words, right?
Well, earlier on, you said that these sorts of structures, these sorts of morphologies are things that people, meaning non-linguists, people know implicitly. How so?
Well, we all have sort of knowledge of how language works, but we may or may not think about that on a conscious level. And a lot of what linguists study is what people know not at a conscious level about what is possible in their language. So often in my own work, what I'm looking at is some of the sort of fringes of the word structure system, of the morphological system, and what speakers know about that. And I bet you've probably never thought about some of these fringes. So if I can give you an example.
Please.
Think about the word beware.
Okay.
So B-E-W-A-R-E. This is a perfectly normal word of English, right? That we can use it in phrases like, you know, beware of that dog over there, right? And that sounds perfectly normal. But think about some of the other forms of that word that we might imagine. How does the phrase, I am bewaring of that dog over there, sound to you?
I would probably circle that on an undergrad paper, I think, if I saw it.
Right. It sounds sort of funny, right? And what sounds funny about it to you?
It just doesn't sound grammatically correct, though right. I probably couldn't tell you why.
Right. Exactly. It's something about the form bewaring, right?
Yeah.
It just doesn't sound quite right to say I am bewaring. But let me give you a different kind of example. Okay. So let's imagine we're just going to make up a new word of the language. Okay. So these are things that linguists do a lot, particularly people who study morphology. These are famously called WUGs in linguistics, W-U-G. If you look that up on Google, you'll see that it's a little picture of a bird-like creature. But let's make up a new word called flurk.
Flurk, okay.
F-L-U-R-K.
All right.
Okay. I can easily say, don't flurk, right? That sounds fine.
Right. Probably.
Now, what if I had to tell you that because you were doing that action right now? How would you describe what you're doing?
I'd say I am flurking.
Right. And probably every native English speaker would say that, right?
Yeah.
So I gave you a totally new word, and you can definitely tell me that the form is flurking.
Yes.
And it sounds
I don't know
completely
why,
fine.
But that just sounds like the form of the word.
Exactly. And so this is part of your implicit knowledge of language. You know that almost any verb of the language can form that ing form, okay, mm-hmm. what we call the progressive in English. But you also know implicitly that beware can't do that. You know that it sounds a little weird to say I am bewaring of the dog or whatever, right?
So why is that? Where does that come from, that sense?
Okay, so this is what's really interesting to me about morphology particularly. So this is a particular phenomenon that linguists call defectiveness, okay? Meaning that there's simply a missing form of the word. There's a form that we expect to exist, bewaring, okay? It seems to operate, you know, it would be what the grammar should produce in some sense, right? We have a root beware and we have a, you know, morpheme ending ing and they should be able to go together and the meaning makes sense. But speakers know you can't do that. And so exactly a lot of the question for me is why do speakers know that you can't do that? And what can it tell us about speakers' knowledge of language and more generally how morphological systems work? So in this particular case, beware has a particularly sort of odd history as a word. Okay. So the Oxford English Dictionary tells us, by the way, the Oxford English Dictionary is a great source of information about the etymology of words. The Oxford English Dictionary tells us that there used to be a verb warian, meaning to guard or take care of. And there was also sort of accidentally an adjective ware, which you could use meaning roughly cautious in a phrase, be where, be cautious. And what happened in the history of the language was that speakers sort of conflated these two and started to treat the verb be and the adjective where as one word that is a verb influenced by this other verb that already existed. And so because it was of form be and an adjective where combined together, speakers weren't sort of willing to stretch it out into all the other forms that could exist. So they don't, you know, you do get sort of sporadic examples of bewares and bewaring, but they sort of don't catch on. Now, what's interesting about that is that it tells us that speakers really were treating that like a construction Okay, so beware as sort of one lumped unit together. And they had made a generalization about that construction as a whole. So they had memorized the forms of that construction. And perhaps because it came from this existing construction, they weren't willing to extend it. And that's what makes it different from that FLIRC example. With FLIRC, you don't have any examples already.
No.
So you take all that implicit knowledge you have of the grammar in general, and you're just willing to apply it. But in the example of beware, because of its history, essentially my idea is that what I sort of propose is that speakers knew many forms, and the fact that they knew some forms made them sort of be able to intuit that the ones they had not heard for a reason, which is to say you couldn't say them. And so they're making generalizations from not having heard things about what it is impossible to say.
What's the scale or scope of defectiveness in our language or in any language?
It varies. It seems to vary. So in English, beware is one tiny example, right? But in other languages, these can become much broader in type. So in Russian, there's a whole famous little class of words that don't have a first person form. So don't have the form for I as the subject. In Greek, there are nouns that are lacking one form of the noun, the genitive plural, for thousands of nouns. You know, so speakers really, you know, can learn generalizations about whole classes of nouns or whole classes of verbs or adjectives that simply lack expected forms. And that's really interesting to me because it really tells us that speakers are making generalizations about sort of related sets of words, especially small little classes of related sets of words. If all they were doing is applying these big rules of grammar, everything would be like FLIRC. But in fact, what they seem to be doing is sort of learning, hey, this word is like that other word I've heard, and building little classes that have similar morphological behavior. And so it's all sort of on this small sort of local scale that people think of words that are similar to words that they've heard before. And that includes not only forming the words similarly, but also learning which words don't have forms that are similar to each other.
So like in English, the example you gave of beware, are the examples you cite in Russian and in Greek, are they also sort of historically contingent as opposed to some sort of, I don't know, defect in a Chomskyan sense, right?
They all have their own sort of unique little histories. So in Greek, the story seems to be that the genitive plural, this form that is used for possession, among other uses, has sort of long been on its way out in the language. That Greek has sort of a long trajectory of losing forms of the noun, and much like English in its history, lost many of its forms of the noun. And it seems to be sort of tied to that, that as the genitive plural gets lost, there are some forms that speakers are unsure how to form, and so they just avoid using them. We have some of this in English as well. I can give you an example if you want.
Please.
So think about the verb forgo.
Forgo, okay.
F-O-R-G-O, or sometimes spelled F-O-R-E-G-O, okay? I can say easily, for example, I decided to forgo dessert yesterday because I've been putting on pounds during the pandemic. Okay? Mm-hmm. Turn that into a past tense for me. Yesterday, I...
Foregoned, but I know that sounds horrible.
Yeah. So some people will say foregone, foregoned,
forwent. Would I say forwent? Maybe.
Would you say forwent though?
I don't know. None of these sound exactly correct.
Exactly. And that's part of the issue here, right? So this is a different kind of sort of source of defectiveness than the beware example that we saw. And it seems to be driven by speakers sort of feeling like they can't find quite the right form. And when you go and you look in corpora, which are large collections of language in use, okay, so spoken usage or written usage or both, what you find is that by and large, people won't use it. That you find lots and lots of examples of all the forms of forgo except that past tense. So speakers just go around it. They find a way to communicate the meaning, but not using that exact grammatical form. In Greek, it's like that, except that it's being pushed along by the fact that in general, that genitive plural is being lost. And so speakers have other ways already of saying that meaning. So they're particularly incentivized to not use the form that they feel very uncomfortable with, or try to figure out what form they're going to use.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Ritter, Executive Dean and Vice Provost for The Ohio State University's College of Arts and Sciences. Did you know 16 of our programs are ranked in the top 25 in U.S. News and World Reports, with 9 of those 16 in the top 10? That's why we say that the College of Arts and Sciences is the intellectual and academic core of The Ohio State University. Learn more about the college at artsinsciences.osu.edu.
Well, I'm interested in the work of your lab, the Dynamics of Morphological Systems Group. And I'm in particular interested in some research that you've done with Grace Lefevre, who is an undergraduate.
Yeah, she actually just got her bachelor's degree in May. She was our most recent graduate class. Yes.
Congratulations, Grace.
Yes. Yeah, so she was writing a BA thesis with me and my colleague Miha Elsner in the linguistics department as co-supervisors. And she wrote a really fantastic thesis that was published in the Proceedings for the Society for Computation in Linguistics this year, actually. And she was the first author on that paper. We're very proud of her.
First author. I mean, that's meaningful in the sciences, being the first author, yes?
Yeah. And she really wrote the paper. I mean, she did the work, and it's a fantastic publication, I think.
What was the work about? What did she examine?
Okay, so it's related to the things that we've been talking about. So an important question in morphological theory recently has been, how easy or hard is it to predict a given form of a word based on one or more other forms of the word? So if we take the Spanish example, pensar, meaning to think, mm-hmm. How easy is it to predict that the first person singular, the I form of that, is going to be pienso and not, say, penso? When you have hablar, it's hablo, not iablo, or something like that, for those of you who speak Spanish better than I do, probably. This is an interesting challenge for a number of reasons. Okay, first of all, it's computationally sort of difficult to build a model that can handle any language. So that was part of what Grace was trying to accomplish and very successfully accomplished, was something that you can feed in any language and it'll start to be able to tell you the difficulty of predicting the different forms of the word. There was also a particular challenge that made her look at Spanish, though, which is that in Spanish, there are what are sometimes described as stem alternations. So pensar, pienso, where you get that extra vowel, right? And mover, to move.
Oh.
Muevo, where you get u, evo, right, part. And hablar, hablo, which doesn't have that change at all. And we might think that speakers can take advantage of the fact that there's a parallelism. So pensar, pienso, mover, muevo, they occur in the same places in the same grammatical forms, what linguists call the same places in the paradigm. But the forms aren't actually the same, right? So in pienso, we've got ie, and in mover, we've got ue. Mm-hmm. And much of the work that's been happening in theoretical morphology sort of recognizes the importance of these parallelisms that are a little bit abstract in the sense that they're not about this sort of actual sounds of the word, okay, but are about the distribution of forms among the paradigm, which is to say they're about the distribution of the different forms of the word in different grammatical meanings. So that's been really important in the theoretical literature, but the computational literature hadn't really caught up with this yet. So Grace, in her thesis, brought together this theoretical work that has looked at the sort of parallelisms in these forms and the way that speakers can use them to predict different forms of the word, and computational linguistics work that seeks to be able to implement this for any language and uses formal mathematical quantification of how difficult this challenge is. And so these are two very different literatures that were looking at the same problem, but hadn't really been in dialogue with each other. And so in her thesis, she's sort of bringing these two literatures into dialogue with each other.
That's amazing. And I know it's not uncommon for a lab to include undergraduates. I mean, you know, postdocs and graduate students, of course, and undergraduates are there. But is it common for an undergraduate to have publishable research as one outcome of their participation in a lab?
Well, certainly not every undergraduate does work of this sort, but in linguistics, we actually really have a culture of undergraduate research. A lot of our undergraduates really get involved in research. Oftentimes, they start as what we call research interns working on projects for advanced graduate students or for faculty members, doing, for instance, linguistic analysis of one sort or another. And then from there, that gives sort of an opportunity to move up into more independent research. So while it may not exactly be the norm, we actually do have quite a number of students who publish their thesis work. And I think that that's a really great thing for the students.
That is. That's fantastic. Well, I mentioned at the outset that you're affiliated with the Buckeye Language Network, and I'd like to learn more about what that network is. But I'm particularly interested to learn about the research you conducted with Laura Wagner in the Department of Psychology.
Sure. First, the Buckeye Language Network is an umbrella organization for all of the people who do language research at Ohio State. And one of the great things about Ohio State, right, is that we are an enormous institution, and we tend to think about that in terms of our student population, but it also enables a lot of collaboration and simply a building of community. So the Buckeye Language Network has more than 60 faculty members that come from 16 departments, most of them in the arts and sciences, but also in other colleges like education and human ecology, engineering and medicine. And it just gives us a framework for getting together and talking to each other on a regular basis about our research and connects us across all of those departments. So I met Laura Wagner originally through the Buckeye Language Network, and we sort of knew each other from around campus. And the project that we worked on together really was about Laura having this idea that American Sign Language worked sort of similarly to Slavic languages.
Interesting.
So this might seem a little unusual, but American Sign Language has a rich system of what's called aspect. So aspect is information that is conveyed by a word's morphology about how the progression of an action takes place. Okay. So the difference between he reads and he is reading, where is reading is more sort of the action is happening more explicitly during some particular time period, can be considered aspect. And Slavic languages like Russian or Croatian do a lot of encoding of information about how the action is progressing, whether it's ongoing or completed, in their word structure. And so Laura was working on a project on American Sign Language and sort of wondered if it worked similarly to Slavic languages. And since I'm trained as a Slavicist, she came to ask me about it. Now, I know, I must say, very little about aspect from the meaning end, but that sort of got us started on a really interesting project that we ended up working on with two collaborators at Harvard, Kate Davidson and Anne-Marie Kokab. So in this project, we were essentially asking whether there is morphology for a specific kind of aspect called telicity, in which the end point of an action is indicated in the verb. So to give you a sense of what this is sort of like, think about the phrase, I drank milk.
Okay, got it.
If in the real world, you only drank one sip of the milk, did you drink milk? Oh. Is that an appropriate way to describe what you did?
I don't know if I would say drank. I sipped.
Okay.
I sipped milk. Maybe I'd say that.
Okay. That's perfectly fine. Imagine you ate one piece of cake.
Okay.
Could you say, I ate cake?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Let's go with that. If you only took one bite of the cake, could you say I ate a piece of cake?
That's probably what I would say.
If you took one bite of the cake, you would say that you ate a piece of cake?
Of course, the piece could be that section. I don't know. I don't know what I'd say.
Okay,
I might say maybe I nibbled it. This is a good question.
So you're somehow a little uncomfortable with saying that you ate a piece of cake if what you did was sort of take one forkful
right,
from that piece.
I guess
piece,
it's definition
right?
of what a piece is.
Yeah, exactly. So if we can agree that a piece is much bigger than the amount that you ate, probably you would say that you didn't eat a piece of cake unless you finished it. Is that fair?
I think so, yes.
Welcome to the world of linguistics. These are the kinds of ways that we poke speakers for their implicit knowledge. Notice that you can use eat both to represent just doing any amount of an action. You know, like I ate cake, right? Or you can use eat to refer to having completed an action. So in this case, a piece in English helps to define where the finish line of your eating is. Okay, so to speak. In English, we are doing this notice with like words like a piece, but in Slavic languages and in American Sign Language, this is done with word structure. So this is one of these areas where there's sort of more word structure than there is in English, more morphology. And in our project, what we were asking is whether American Sign Language has word structure that conveys that difference of meaning between an action that, you know, any tiny amount of it is having done the action, like dancing. If I get up from my chair right now and dance in my office for 2 minutes, I can say I danced. It doesn't matter how long I did it, but if I danced a ballet, I have to have done the whole thing.
Right.
Right. That can be conveyed not by extra words like in English, but by word structure, by morphology in other languages. And it's unclear in American Sign Language whether it's on that line between conveying the meaning with different words or actually having it be part of the grammar of the language. So in our project, the four of us, Laura Wagner and I and our collaborators, were looking at whether American Sign Language has developed this kind of grammar and how robust it is in the language. Now, the thing that I think is particularly interesting about American Sign Language here is that it seems to be sort of on the border. There are some words that seem very systematically to have two different forms depending on whether the action has been completed or not. But there are some words that don't. And so it's sort of one of those areas where grammatical structure seems to be developing. And that's very normal for language. So this isn't something that's particular to sign languages. It happens in all languages. Okay. And American Sign Language is a well-functioning language. But it gives us some insight into how new morphological distinctions get created. American Sign Language is relatively young by the standards of languages. And we can see to some degree the development of grammatical systems in real time in a way that we don't always have the opportunity to see in other languages like, say, English.
Well, this sounds like very interdisciplinary sort of work. Is that how you would define your approach? Or do you think of yourself as sort of an interdisciplinary scholar?
I would certainly like to. I do try to collaborate a lot with colleagues in other areas. So I actually work very little with other morphologists. Laura Wagner, she's from the psychology department. Mm-hmm. I work with my colleague in linguistics, Miha Elsner, who's a computational linguist. And I work with others in sort of other areas. It's a great opportunity for me to learn from their expertise and, you know, contribute my own as well. And I think that this kind of interdisciplinary collaboration is both really common and really important in linguistics, because linguistics has a cognitive aspect to it. It's a cognitive science. It's also a social science. There's a social aspect to language. Mm-hmm. There are wide cross-linguistic differences in how languages work. We need to investigate a lot of languages, including with people who speak those languages natively or at a fluent level. We need to look at language from many different angles. And so that requires a lot of interdisciplinary collaboration, even within our field of linguistics. We think of ourselves as an interdisciplinary field.
You might have already gestured to this, but I'm interested to know, what would you describe as sort of the biggest change in the field of linguistics, say in the last, I don't know, 30 or 40 years or so?
So one of the largest differences in the field of linguistics, one of the things that has really changed, has a lot to do with my particular subfield of morphology. Mm-hmm. So linguistics has a really long tradition of dividing language into two types of systems, let's say. grammar and lexicon. Grammar is regularity, systematicity. You can think of it as the rules. Lexicon is everything that's idiosyncratic about a language. So in English, we have this word chair. In Spanish, that same thing is referred to as a silla, I believe. In Croatian, it's referred to as a stolica. Languages have different words, right? And that's something that we can't predict from the meaning. It's something that we have to store in our mental dictionaries, which linguists call the lexicon. So in the history of linguistics, this differentiation into what's grammar, what's the rules of a language, and the lexicon, all these sort of idiosyncratic stuff you have to memorize, basically turned the lexicon into a dumping ground for all the stuff that linguists were not interested in. So there's this quite famous quote in which it says that the lexicon is like a prison. It contains only the lawless, and the only thing its inmates have in common is lawlessness. Which I sort of love as a description of linguistics in the 20th century, let's say. But that view has really been eroded. So it's come to be recognized more and more that there's not this sharp distinction between the words we know and the grammar that we know. Okay? So between that lexicon and grammar, between what's idiosyncratic and what's regular. So we've already seen a few examples of this where you have this knowledge of words that can't be used. How do you know that? Is it part of your knowledge of the rules, or is it part of something you memorized? I would argue that that's really a false distinction. And that's the way the field has really been moving. So when I went to graduate school, there were no jobs for morphologists. Huh. I mean, literally no jobs. In the year that I graduated, there was not a single academic job opening advertised for a morphologist. And that's really not true anymore. And part of that is because my subfield morphology, the study of word structure, is exactly where we get these sort of fuzzy boundaries, particularly between grammar and lexicon, where a lot of the evidence has come from, that the boundaries are not very sharp. That in fact, what we tend to think of now in the field of linguistics is that what grammar is, what the rules you know about your language at some unconscious level, what those are is really generalizations you've made over words and small constructions that you've memorized. And if we think about it in that way, we really have to know a lot about word structure in order to know about the rules. Because it all sort of, from my own very biased perspective as a morphologist, it all really starts from the word structure, and the generalizations come from the words. And so I think that that's been a really huge change in the field of linguistics. And I'm very happy in my research group, the Dynamics and Morphological Systems group, to be training a bunch of students now in morphology, and that there really are morphologists, people who identify as morphologists, and jobs in morphology. That this whole subfield of linguistics, which had sort of been banished from the field, so to speak, in the 20th century, has really made a huge resurgence. And that it's really interesting to me to see that undergraduate students and graduate students coming up really see the value of morphology in a way that was not at all typical for the field when I was coming up.
Tell us what's next for your research.
So I was trained as a Slavicist. I work on Russian, and I also work especially on the sets of languages that we used to call Serbo-Croatian and now call by separate names, Croatian, Bosnian, Serbian, and Montenegrin. But my most recent work has really gotten me interested in broader questions about linguistic diversity. One thing that we talked about earlier, one thing that we know is that languages differ substantially in how much morphology they have. And I've really been starting to think about how word structure might differ from one language to another, and particularly how the ways in which speakers are developing generalizations about word structure, by which I mean the way that they memorize words and connect those words in their mental lexicon, in their mental dictionary, might shape how languages change over time and lead to this diversity and be affected by this great diversity of languages. So I've really been starting to take a broader, what we call typological view, a view of linguistic diversity more directly. So I'm really interested in thinking about languages as networks. So one thing that you mentioned in the introduction is that I'm part of the computational social sciences community of practice here at Ohio State through the Translational Data Analytics Institute. And this is the part of my work that connects to that most directly. So we can think of languages, and particularly we can think of morphological systems, the word structure, as a network. So words are connected in the network if they have the same word structure properties, let's say. So they form their grammatical forms of words in the same way. And it turns out something that had never really been noticed is that if you think of it as a network in this sense, languages actually differ a lot in the structure of their networks. And that makes really interesting predictions for how languages might change that connects us to sort of broader work that's happening out there. So one of the more interesting things, I think, beyond the purview of linguistics specifically, is that there's been this rise in complex systems theory and in network theory in other fields, in sociology, in political science, in chemistry, in economics, in a whole variety of fields, which are all interested in complex systems, by which we mean really a system with a large number of elements that interact with each other in their environment, where they display organization that doesn't have any external organizing principle. They're self-organizing in some sense, and the structure of the whole network is more than the sum of its parts, let's say. We can think of language in the same way. We can think about morphological systems in the same way. And it turns out that there's a lot of diversity in this respect. And I'm interested in the predictions that we might be able to draw from complex systems theory and network theory for how languages might change over time. And that's where I'm going with my current work.
Andrea Sims, thank you.
Thank you very much, David.
Voices from the Arts and Sciences is produced and recorded at the Ohio State University College of Arts and Sciences Technology Services Studio. Sound engineering by Paul Kotheimer, produced by Doug Dangler. I'm Ava Dale.